The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Morris Williams, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to another wonderful event at the Free Library of Philadelphia. We're starting a couple of minutes late because there was a very large group of people waiting to get their tickets, and so we not only have a sellout downstairs, but we have a large population upstairs as well. So it's a great evening and a great event. Let me first ask you to please turn off your cell phones. And also to remind you, no flash photography during the event. There will be a Q&A after Dr. Diamond's talk. I do urge you to go and buy The World Until Yesterday, which is his new book about which he will be talking this evening. You may be interested to know that Dr. Diamond was born in Boston and remains a loyal supporter of the Boston Red Sox. He is a BD graduate from Harvard University. He got his PhD from the University of Cambridge in England. You may be interested to know that his thesis, the title of his PhD thesis, was Concentrating Activity of a Gallbladder. So he's traveled quite a distance in terms of his original research and what The World Until Yesterday talks about. But I think it's also interesting to think about the fields in which he is interested. They include physiology, biophysics, ornithology, environmentalism, history, ecology, geography, evolutionary biology, and anthropology. So many of those items are characterized and covered in his book in terms of what we can learn from traditional societies. Since probably his most famous book was Three Words, Guns, Germs, and Steel, I tried to think of, I came up with four words that I think perhaps you can ask him whether it summarizes his focus in terms of what we can learn from traditional societies. One is mediation. The second two words are constructive paranoia. And the third is balance. And by balance, he actually outlines that he's talking about exercise, eating slowly, and talking with friends while you eat. Ladies and gentlemen, it's my great privilege to introduce and invite Dr. Diamond to the stage to tell us all about The World Until Yesterday. Let's give him a wonderful Philadelphia welcome. And notice he has a red coat for the Red Sox.
Let me first check whether you'll be able to hear me okay in back. Can you hear in back? It's a great pleasure to be back in Philadelphia today and to be back in this wonderful library to talk about subjects other than gallbladders. Instead, to give me an idea how many of you here this evening may find what I'm about to tell you of practical value, I'd like to ask you to raise your hands to one or the other of two questions that I'll now pose. First, could those of you raise your hand who either are over age 65 or hope to live past age 65 or have a parent or grandparent over 65? Many of you? All right. Then the second group, let me ask, please raise your hand if you are under 65, have no intention of living past 65, and have no parent or grandparent who passed 65. Raise your hand. All right, we have a smattering. Those of you who in the first group, you're the ones to whom I think my talk this evening will be of practical value. Those of you who in the second group, my talk will not be of practical value, but I think you'll still find this subject fascinating. I'm going to talk about growing older in traditional societies. This subject is just one chapter of my latest book, which compares traditional small societies with our big modern societies with respect to many aspects of society, such as growing old, bringing up children, health, dealing with danger, settling disputes, war, religion, and speaking more than one language. This book is my most personal book, my book of, I think, the most practical value to our daily lives, and as a shameless author, I hope it's going to be my best-selling book. It's about what I've learned from spending a lot of my time in traditional tribal societies in New Guinea over the last 50 years, and it's about what friends and other scholars have learned from other tribal societies around the world. All of us here this evening are accustomed to living in big industrial societies, in permanent housing, with central governments to make decisions, with writing and books and the internet, where most people live past age 60, where we regularly encounter strangers, just as I'm encountering you this evening, and where most of us eat food grown by older people. We forget that every one of those things arose very recently in human history. Humans have constituted a separate line of biological evolution for about 6 million years, but all of the things that I just mentioned didn't exist anywhere in the world 11,000 years ago. They arose only within the last 11,000 years, and some of them, such as the internet and the phenomenon of most people living past age 60, arose only within the last century or two. That is, the ancestors of all of us here were living under traditional tribal conditions until virtually yesterday, measured on that 6 million year timescale of human evolution. Until Europeans started to expand around the world 500 years ago, tribal societies still occupied large parts of all of the continents. But tribal societies have recently been coming under the control of modern societies with state governments, to the point where today the last tribal societies not yet under state control are confined to just small areas of New Guinea and the Amazon basin. Those tribal societies, which constituted all human societies for most of human history, are far more diverse than are our modern big societies. All big societies that have governments and where most people are strangers to each other are similar to each other and different from tribal societies in many basic ways, regardless of whether our big societies are American, German, Chinese, Israeli, or whatever. Tribes constitute thousands of natural experiments in how to run a human society. They constitute experiments from which we ourselves may be able to learn. For example, today, if you think that modern American children enjoy too much freedom, or else if you think that modern American children aren't given enough freedom, you cannot perform the decisive experiment of designating 17 American states where kids have to remain strictly subservient to their parents and grandparents, 17 other states where babies will be given the freedom to make their decisions and to play with sharp knives from the age of 2 onwards, and 16 other states where children continue to be treated as they're treated today. If we could only carry out that controlled experiment, we could come back in 40 years, compare the children from all those states, and quickly settle the question whether it's better to raise kids with more freedom, less freedom, or the same freedom that they enjoy today. Unfortunately, it's impossible to carry out that decisive experiment in the U.S., but there are thousands of traditional societies in which children already did grow up with either much more freedom or much less freedom than in the modern U.S. By examining what actually does or did happen in traditional societies that are much more varied than modern American society, we may be able to learn things of practical value to us in deciding how to raise our kids, how to treat our older people, how to remain healthy, and other things that we care a lot about. Tribal society shouldn't be scorned as primitive and miserable, but also they shouldn't be idealized as happy and peaceful. When we learn of tribal practices, some of them will horrify us, but there are other tribal practices which, when we hear about them, we may admire and envy them and wonder whether we could adopt those practices ourselves. To get some perspective on how we treat elderly people in Western modern societies, let me tell you the opinion of a friend of mine from the Fiji Islands in the Pacific, who had visited the United States. There were some things that my friend admired about the U.S., other things that he disliked about the U.S., but what he most loathed about the U.S. was our treatment of older people. He almost shouted at me indignantly, "You Americans throw away your older people." Those were his words. By that, he meant that most old people in the U.S. end up living separately from their children and separately from most of their friends of their earlier years, and often live in separate retirement homes for the elderly. In Fiji and other traditional societies, older people instead live out their lives among their children, their other relatives, and their lifelong friends. Nevertheless, the treatment of the elderly varies enormously among traditional societies, from much worse to much better than in our modern societies. At the worst extreme, many traditional societies get rid of their elderly in one of five increasingly direct ways. The most indirect method to get rid of the elderly is just to neglect them and not to feed them or clean them until they die. The second method is to abandon them when the group moves on. The third method is to encourage older people to commit suicide. A fourth, more direct method is to kill older people with their own cooperation. For example, among the Kaolong people of Papua New Guinea, a widow whose husband has just died asks her brothers or sons to come strangle her. The fifth and most direct method to get rid of the elderly is to kill them without their consent or cooperation. In what tribal societies do children abandon or kill their parents? It happens mainly under two conditions. One is in nomadic hunter-gatherer societies that often shift camp and that are physically incapable of transporting old people who can't walk when the able-bodied younger people already have to carry their young children and their physical possessions. The other condition for getting rid of older people is in societies living in marginal or fluctuating environments, such as the Arctic or shortages, and occasionally there just isn't enough food to keep everyone alive. Whatever food is available has to be reserved for able-bodied people still capable of contributing to the tribe's survival and for the children who will grow up to be the tribe's future adults. Can you still hear okay?
Yes.
Okay, good. To us modern Americans, it sounds horrible to think of abandoning or killing your own sick spouse or your own elderly parent. But what else could those societies do? They face a cruel choice. Their old people had to do it with their own parents, and the old people know what now is going to happen to them. For any of you who are nevertheless still inclined to blame those tribal societies for abandoning or killing the elderly, let me quote the words of Winston Churchill about the behavior of the Japanese Admiral Kurita at the Battle of Leyte Gulf in October 1944, when Admiral Kurita had to choose between two equally horrible options. Winston Churchill said of Kurita, "Those of you who have endured a similar ordeal may judge him. In fact, many of you, many of us here, have already faced or will face an ordeal similar to the ordeal faced by those nomadic or Arctic or desert tribal societies when you are the physician or the relative responsible for the medical care of an old person, and when you are the one who has to decide whether and when to halt further medical interventions and when just to administer painkillers." At the opposite extreme in the treatment of the elderly, the happy extreme, are the New Guinea farming societies where I've been doing my field work for the past 50 years, and the village society of my Fijian friend and many other sedentary traditional societies around the world. In those societies, older people are cared for, they are fed, they remain valuable, and they continue to live in the same hut or else in a nearby hut near their children, their relatives, and their lifelong friends. In traditional New Guinea societies where there aren't dentists and where older people gradually lose their teeth and can no longer chew their own food, their adult children chew the food until it's soft, spit the food into a cup, and give that soft, pre-chewed food to the toothless old person to eat. I don't know of any modern Western society in which such devoted care of old parents is routine. There are two main sets of reasons for this variation among societies in their treatment of old people. The variation depends especially on the usefulness of old people and on the society's values. First, as regards usefulness, older people continue to perform useful services in traditional societies and also in our modern societies. One use of older people in traditional societies is that often they're still effective at producing food. For example, among the Hadza hunter-gatherers of Tanzania, grandmothers are the most productive women at finding and digging up wild edible roots because grandmothers have much more experience than younger women at finding the roots, and they often still have enough strength to dig them up. Hence, measurements show that the growth rate of a Hadza grandchild increases with the amount of time that the grandmother of the kid spends foraging to get food for the kid. While older Hadza hunter-gatherer men may no longer have the strength needed to spear a lion, the men may still be useful in their old age at following animal tracks and at capturing slow or small prey. The lifetime experience of older men means that they know much more than the younger men about the habits of each species of prey animal and about how best to hunt that animal. That value of the experience of older people in traditional societies has also been confirmed for modern farming societies. Among 19th century Canadian farmers and 19th century Finnish farmers, each decade that a grandmother survived past age 50 was correlated with two extra grandchildren of that grandmother eventually surviving because of the grandmother's contribution to resources while still alive. Another traditional usefulness of older people consists of babysitting their grandchildren, thereby freeing up their own adult children, the parents of those grandchildren, to go hunting and gathering food for the grandchildren. Still another traditional value of older people is in making tools, weapons, baskets, pots, and textiles. In fact, older people are usually the people who are best at those things. Older people usually are the leaders of traditional societies, people most knowledgeable about medicine, religion, politics, songs, and dances. That's the origin of our expression, tribal elders. To some extent, that's still true today. The average age of American presidents, on assuming the presidency, is 54 years old. Finally, older people in traditional societies have one more huge significance that would never occur to us in our modern literate societies, where our sources of information are books and the internet. In contrast, in traditional societies without writing, older people are the repositories of information. Their knowledge spells the difference between survival and death for the whole society in a time of crisis caused by rare events of which only the oldest people alive have had experience. For example, in 1976, I visited a remote Polynesian island in the Pacific Ocean called Rennell Island in order to do an environmental impact study for a proposed mining project. As part of my study, I asked Rennell Islanders to tell me the name of each species of forest tree in their Polynesian language and to tell me for each tree species whether its fruit or seed was edible. The islanders began to answer me. This tree's fruit is eaten by people. That tree's fruit is eaten by bats, but not by people. This tree's fruit is eaten by birds, not bats or people. But that fruit isn't edible to people or to any animal, and so on. Then the islanders came to a tree of which they said, people eat after a hungi kenge. I didn't know what a hungi kenge is, but I let the islanders keep talking about more fruit eaten by people or by birds or by bats, and then they came to another fruit, just eaten by people after a hungi kenge, and then several more fruits eaten only after a hungi kenge. I was now really curious, and so I asked them, what is a hungi kenge, and why are there some fruits that you eat only after a hungi kenge? To answer me, the islanders took me to a hut, inside of which and back was sitting a woman around 80 years old who was now virtually blind and unable to walk. The islanders explained to me that when that woman, that old woman, was only a teenager, Rennell Island had been hit by an enormous cyclone, which they called the Hungi Kenge, and which destroyed all the gardens and much of the forest on Rennell Island. That left people at risk of starving, and so they survived by eating certain species of wild fruits that they normally wouldn't eat, but that old people alive at the time of the Hungi Kenge remembered had been eaten at the time of a previous cyclone. From historical records of Pacific Island cyclones, I calculated that the Hungi Kenge had hit Rennell Island around the year 1910, when the old woman the people were showing me was just a teenager. She was the oldest person still alive on Rennell Island at the time of my visit. If another big cyclone should hit Rennell Island now and again destroy the gardens and much of the forest, the only thing that would save the population of Rennell Island from starving to death would be the memories of that one old woman, the sole person alive who remembered what fruits that were normally considered inedible were safe to eat when nothing else was available. Her knowledge was what would keep her fellow islanders alive until their gardens began producing again. In the U.S., though, we don't rely on oral memory. We instead look up the answers to questions in a book or we Google it. More than any incident in all my years working on Pacific Islands, that story of that old, blind, and lame woman in the hut on Rennell Island made me appreciate the overwhelming importance of the knowledge of older people throughout human history, before there was writing, in non-literate traditional societies, where the knowledge of older people spells the difference between life and death for their entire society. Those, then, are the ways in which older people are useful in traditional societies. Their usefulness varies among traditional societies and contributes to variation in the society's treatment of the elderly. The other set of reasons for variation in treatment of the elderly is the society's cultural values, which vary somewhat independently of the usefulness of the elderly. For example, among large societies that have had centralized governments for thousands of years, there is particular emphasis on respect for the elderly in East Asia, associated with the philosophy of Confucius and with his doctrine of filial piety. Filial piety means obedience, respect, and support for elderly parents. Cultural values that emphasize respect for older people, such as filial piety, contrast with the low status of the elderly in the United States. Older Americans are at a disadvantage in getting jobs. For example, a sociologist at Boston University carried out the experiment of submitting dozens of job applications in response to ads by prospective employers. All of the applications gave fictitious names of women, and all of the applications were identical, except that half of the applications gave the woman applicant's ages 25 to 40, while the other half of the applications gave her ages 45 to 60. The result of the experiment was that employers were twice as likely to call a woman age 25 to 40 for a job interview as a woman age 45 to 60. Another example of the low status of the elderly in the U.S. is an explicit policy in our hospitals called age-based allocation of healthcare resources. Listen to those words. Age-based allocation of healthcare resources. That expression is a cruel euphemism. It means that if hospital resources are limited, for example, if there's only a certain number of hospital beds, heart becomes available for transplant, or if a surgeon has time to operate on only a certain number of patients. Technical glitch.
Go ahead. Keep talking.
Should I take off my glasses, do you think?
Okay, go ahead.
I have seen the James Bond movie of about 15 years ago in which the evil head of a Hamburg media network has the lights turned out in his whole building by James Bond, and the evil head says, short technical interruption. All right, I'm not an evil media head, but you've had a short technical interruption. So, we've talked, I was just talking then about age-based allocation of healthcare resources. American hospitals have an explicit policy of giving preference to younger patients over older patients on the grounds that younger patients are more valuable to society, supposedly, because they have more years of life ahead of them, even though the younger patients have fewer years of valuable life experience behind them. There are several reasons for this low status of the elderly in the United States. The high status of the elderly in East Asia is based on the Asian emphasis on filial piety. The low status of elderly Americans arises from several American values that replace filial piety. One is our Protestant work ethic, which places high value on work so that older people who are no longer working aren't respected. Another reason is our American emphasis on the virtues of self-reliance and independence, so that we instinctively scorn older people who are no longer self-reliant and independent. Still, a third reason is our American cult of youth. That cult of youth shows up in our advertisements. Ads for Coca-Cola and beer, just picture them. They always depict smiling young people, even though old people as well as young people buy and drink Coca-Cola and beer. Just ask yourself, what's the last time you saw a Coke or beer ad depicting smiling people 75 or 80 years old? Never. Instead, the only American ads featuring white-haired old people are ads for retirement homes, ads for pension planning, and ads for adult diapers. Well, what has changed in the status of the elderly today compared to their status in traditional societies? There have been a few changes for the better and more changes for the worse. Big changes for the better include the facts that today we enjoy much longer lives, much better health in our old age, and much better recreational opportunities. Also, our older people rarely have had to experience grief from the death of their own child, whereas in traditional societies, parents routinely have to grieve over the deaths of many or most of their children. Another change for the better in the lives of older people is that we now have specialized retirement facilities and programs to take care of older people. Changes for the worse begin with the cruel reality that we now have far more old people and fewer young people than at any time in the past. That means that all those old people are more of a burden on the few young people, and that each old person has less individual value. On Rennell Island, when I visited there in 1976, there was only that one old woman still alive who remembered how to survive after the Hungi Kengi of 1910. If there had been hundreds of survivors of the 1910 Hungi Kengi still alive in 1976, any single one of those hundreds of survivors would not have been as individually valuable. Another big change for the worse in the status of the elderly is the breaking of social ties with age, because older people, their children and their friends, all move and scatter independently of each other many times during their lives. The average American moves every 5 years. And so our older people are very likely to end up living distant from their children and living distant from the friends of their youth. Yet another change for the worse in the status of the elderly is formal retirement from the workforce, carrying with it a loss of work friendships and a loss of the self-esteem associated with work. Perhaps the biggest of all the changes for the worse in the status of our elderly is that they are objectively less useful than in traditional societies. Widespread literacy means that they are no longer useful as the repositories of knowledge. When we want some information, we look it up in a book or we Google it instead of finding some old person to ask. State-mandated systems of formal education mean that children are taught at particular hours on particular days by particularly young, full-time professional teachers, rather than being taught by all of the older adults as part of everyday life. Finally, the slow pace of technological change in traditional societies means that what someone learns there as a child is still useful when that person is old. But the rapid pace of technological change today means that what we learn as children is no longer useful 60 years later. And we older people aren't fluent in the technologies essential to surviving in modern society. For example, as a 15-year-old high school student, I was considered outstandingly good at multiplying two-digit numbers because I had memorized the multiplication tables, and I know how to use logarithms, and I'm quick at manipulating a slide rule. Today, though, skill at multiplication tables and logs and slide rules is utterly useless because today any idiot can multiply eight-digit numbers accurately and instantly with a pocket calculator. Conversely, I, at age 75, am incompetent at skills essential for everyday life. My family's first television set that we acquired in 1948 had only three knobs that I quickly mastered. There was an on-off switch, there was a volume knob, and there was a channel selector knob. Today, just to watch a television program on the television set in my own living room, I have to operate a 41-button TV remote that I still find utterly confusing, although my children have explained it to me. To watch television, I have to telephone my 25-year-old sons and ask them to talk me through it while I try to push those wretched 41 buttons. What can we do to improve the lives of the elderly in the U.S. and to make better use of their value? That's a huge problem. In my remaining few minutes today, I can offer just a few suggestions. One value of older people is that they are increasingly useful for offering high-quality child care if they choose to do it. As more and more younger women enter the workforce and as fewer young parents stay home as full-time caretakers of their children, compared to the usual alternatives of paid babysitters and daycare centers, grandparents offer superior, motivated, experienced child care. They've already gained experience from raising their own kids. Usually, they love their grandchildren, and they're eager to be permitted to spend time with their grandchildren. Unlike other caregivers, grandparents don't quit their babysitting job because they found another job with higher pay and more Social Security and medical benefits. But there's also a downside to grandparents as babysitters. With the increasing age at which couples are having babies today, the couple's parents often don't become grandparents until they're in their 70s and 80s, when they may no longer have the necessary physical stamina to babysit their grandchildren. A second value of older people today is paradoxically related to their loss of value as a result of changing world conditions and technology. At the same time, older people have gained in value today precisely because of their unique experience of former conditions that have now become rare because of rapid change, but that could come back. For example, only people now in their 70s or older today can remember the experience of living through a Great Depression, the experience of living through a world war, the experience of living through food and gas rationing, and the experience of debating whether or not dropping atomic bombs would be more horrible than the likely consequences of not dropping atomic bombs. Most of our current voters and leaders and politicians have no personal experience of any of those things, but millions of older Americans do. Unfortunately, all of those terrible situations could come back. Even if they don't come back, we have to be able to plan for them on the basis of the experience of what they were like. Older people, older politicians and voters, have that experience. Younger people, younger politicians and voters don't have that experience. The remaining value of older people that I'll mention involves recognizing that while there are many things that older people can no longer do, there are other things that they can do much better than younger people. A challenge for our society is to make use of those things that older people are better at doing. Some abilities, of course, decrease with age. They include abilities at tasks requiring physical strength and stamina, ambition, and the power of novel reasoning in a narrowly circumscribed situation, such as figuring out the structure of DNA best left to scientists under the age of 30. Conversely, valuable attributes that increase with age include experience, understanding of people and human relationships, ability to help other people without your own ego getting in the way of your advice, and interdisciplinary thinking about large databases, such as biogeography and comparative history, best left to scholars over the age of 60, or best of all, over the age of 75. Hence, older people are better than younger people at supervising, administering, advising, strategizing, teaching, and synthesizing. I've seen these values of older people with so many of my friends in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, friends who are still active into their 90s as farmers, lawyers, and surgeons. In short, many traditional societies make better use of their elderly and give their elderly more satisfying lives than we do in modern big societies. Paradoxically, nowadays, when we have more elderly people than ever before, living healthier lives and with better medical care than ever before, old age is in many respects more miserable than ever before. The lives of the elderly are widely considered as constituting a disaster area of modern American society. We can surely do better by learning from the lives of the elderly in traditional societies. But what's true of the lives of the elderly in traditional societies is true of many other features of traditional societies as well. Of course, I'm not advocating that we all give up agriculture and metal tools, return to hunting and gathering, live in small tribes, and resume making tribal war against neighboring tribes. There are many obvious respects in which our lives today are, of course, far happier than those of small traditional societies. To mention just a few examples, our lives are longer, materially much richer, and less plagued by violence than are the lives of people in traditional societies. But there are also things to be admired about people in traditional societies and perhaps to be learned from them. Their lives in traditional societies are usually socially much richer than our lives, although materially poorer. Their children in traditional societies are often or usually more self-confident, more independent, more socially skilled, and more precocious than are the lives of our children. They in traditional societies essentially never die of diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, stroke, and the other non-communicable diseases that would be the causes of death of most of us here in this room today. And that's not just because they in traditional societies don't live long enough to get diabetes and those other diseases. Even when you make comparisons at the same age, people living traditional lifestyles are far less likely to get diabetes and heart disease and those other non-communicable diseases than are Americans of the same age. Features of the modern lifestyle predispose us to those diseases, while features of the traditional lifestyle protect us against those diseases. Other chapters of my book deal with other aspects of society besides old age. I have a chapter on dispute resolution, which in traditional societies aims at emotional closure, reconciliation between the parties involved in a dispute, whereas any of you who've been involved in a civil or criminal law case in the United States, any of you who've been involved in or know a divorcing couple, or brother or sister, parents and children, who've been involved in an inheritance dispute, you know that the last thing that the American court system cares about is emotional reconciliation. Instead, the government cares about right and wrong. And people end up miserable as a result, often. Warfare, another two chapters in my book, is chronic in traditional societies and involves killing not just young soldier-age men, but women and children, and there are reasons for that. Child-rearing is quite different in traditional societies, and that provides some big surprises that contribute to the fact that children in traditional societies are more independent, self-assured, capable of making their own decisions, socially precocious. Children and babies in traditional societies are carried vertically, uprights facing forwards, not horizontally as in a baby carriage, or vertically facing backwards, and that affects development of neuromotor skills. In traditional societies, parents respond quickly, within 10 seconds, preferably within 3 seconds, to an infant crying. There's none of this nonsense about letting a baby cry itself out. And in traditional societies, there are lots of alternative parent models. Every adult in the village or in the tribe is a parent model, and so that means more social role models for a child to learn from than just its parents. Dangers play out differently in traditional societies than in our society. People in traditional societies without 911 and police and doctors are much more attentive than are we to the risks of events which each time they carry a low risk of getting hurt, but you're going to repeat that event many times in your lifetime. People in traditional societies judge dangers realistically. So, for example, I've learned today the most dangerous thing that I did was to take a shower. You may say, what's so dangerous about that? My chances of slipping in the shower are less than 1 in 1,000. Well, just read the obituary column of the newspaper. You'll see that a common cause of death or crippling for older people is slipping in the shower or on the sidewalk or on a stepladder. And if your chances of getting hurt slipping in the shower are only 1 in 1,000, you think that's good, forget it. I intend to take a shower every day for the next 15 or so years of my life. That means 5,475 showers. And if my risk of slipping is 1 in 1,000, I'm going to get killed 5 times before I live out my quota of showers in my next 15 years. Religion plays different functions in traditional societies and modern societies. And that lets one imagine what is going to be the future of religion in the next century. Multilingualism, which in the United States is debated and often feared, multilingualism is routine in traditional societies. And one surprising discovery of the last 5 years is that the best protection that we now know of against the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease is not bridge or Sudoku or any medicine, none of which helps. The best protection is being bilingual. Being bilingual gives you 5 years protection against symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. And we don't know yet whether being multilingual gives you 5 years protection multiplied times the number of your extra languages. Those are just some examples, then, of what we can learn from traditional societies. I hope that you find it as fascinating to read in my book about traditional societies as I found it to live in them. Thank you.
So we'll take questions for about 15 minutes. You can walk around in front of the podium. Okay.
Thank you very much, Dr. Diamond. At this point, we will take questions. The way it works is you raise your hand, and I will call on you, and we'll get a microphone to you. Who would like to start us off? There's a lady in orange on the aisle there.
Hi. First of all, thank you for that. That was really fascinating. I have a question, though. Your book is about what we can learn from traditional societies, and it seems like you're talking about a lot of different activities, some of which are beneficial to learn from them, some of which aren't. And I was just wondering if you had like a rule or something for deciding which things we should imitate and which things we should leave. Is that like it?
Fair enough. Yeah, it is true that I'm not saying that we should imitate everything in traditional societies, nor am I saying that we should despise everything in traditional societies. Some of the things that we should not imitate are obvious. We should not imitate strangling our parent. We should not imitate starving to death. We should not imitate killing a baby if the baby is born weak. Things that we should imitate are anything that is likely to result in children being more self-confident and more socially skilled. We should certainly imitate anything that results in our never getting diabetes, heart disease, or stroke. We should imitate anything that makes us attentive to the realistic dangers, rather than obsessing about terrorists and plane crashes that are going to kill very few people compared to showers. But you're correct that there's a middle ground where it's not so clear what to imitate. For example, it's the case that in traditional societies, people never, never, never spank their children. And yet there is a debate in American society, in European society, whether or not you should spank your kids. In Sweden, it's a criminal act to spank your children. In Germany, at least when I lived in Germany, it was considered not criminal, but really stupid not to spank your children. So that just illustrates that there are things where we have to figure out whether it makes sense, or whether, for example, you're going to take your infant into bed with you. It's debated. Many pediatricians advise against it. And yet, every baby in human history slept in bed with its parents until the last 5 or 10,000 years. So that's a long-winded way of saying some things are obviously good, some things are obviously bad, some things we have to figure out.
Another question. Right here in the corner, Marianne.
I was intrigued by you talking about the freedom that the children have. I was interested in knowing what you are seeing through history and today about what's better, either to have more freedom for the kids or less freedom.
That's a really good question to follow up on your question, because so how much freedom should a baby have? In New Guinea society, when I began working in New Guinea in 1964, I noticed that virtually all New Guinea Highlanders had scars, fire scars in their arms, and I thought they'd gotten burnt lighting fire. But no, most of them got burnt as infants, because in Highland New Guinea, where children are considered independent people capable of making their own decisions, it's also considered the baby playing next to a fire can decide whether it's going to roll into the fire or not. Babies learn from that, but I think few Americans would argue that a baby should have the freedom to roll into a fire. Among many traditional societies, babies are permitted to play with sharp knives. I think most of us, I certainly, my wife and I, did not let our kids play with sharp knives, but there are lots of other things that children are permitted to do in traditional societies which go entirely against the grain of our micromanaging our own children. So your question fits with the previous question. Some things we certainly should permit our children to do. Other things, although traditional societies do it, we may feel uncomfortable with it.
Yes, against the wall on our left.
You've been talking about how traditional societies impact us. What about the other direction? A place like New Guinea, where these people are emerging very badly from their traditional society, the place is corrupt, and many people have a very difficult time with this. Can you make any suggestions about how that would work better?
The flip side of the coin about the significance of the traditional societies for us is what's the impact that the modern world is having on traditional societies. And every traditional society that I know of, when it hears about the outside world and what the outside world has, wants to acquire some of that stuff. Traditional people, when they see steel axes, they want steel axes instead of stone axes, because steel axes are sharper and they hold their edge for longer. They want matches rather than fire drills. They want clothing, manufactured clothing, instead of shivering in the rain. They want umbrellas. They want medicines. They want educational opportunities for their kids. Throughout the world, traditional societies are wanting to acquire some things from modern outside society. But this acquisition is selective. And I think the important thing is that traditional societies should be free to make their own choice rather than be dragged into the modern world against their will, notably by being exterminated, driven off the land, conquered, dispossessed.
And there was a lady right in front of that gentleman.
One thing, I have a huge voice. One thing that I noted when I lived in Hawaii for 20 years is that many, many grandparents were raising their children, their children's children, excuse me, their grandchildren, in effect. And my mother was 42 when she had us, which was almost an impossibly unfashionable age. And I noted the same two things, that the older the parent was in many, the grandparent was in many instances, the children wound up almost losing a generation of perspective alternatives because of their grandparents. They grew up more racist, frankly. They grew up more superstitious. And they grew up with a kind of ethos that didn't necessarily suit them for the generation that they were entering. That's the one caution that I have when I look at what you're suggesting.
Sure, fair enough. I mean, all of you parents of young children, you've got to figure out, do you How much caregiving do you want to turn over to your parents, the grandparents of the children? In many cases, among my friends, many of my friends are utterly thrilled to have their children looked after by their grandparents. And others of my friends say there is no way that, seriously, that my kids are going to get looked after by the grandparents. So I'm not making a universal recommendation. I'm merely saying that nowadays, under modern circumstances, grandparents, if they want to do it, and if the parents want them to do it, are more valuable than in the past because of the demographic changes.
Question right in the front row here. Could you wait for the mic, please?
Just as a follow-up of that, when you're comparing roles, somebody can be a grandparent, I would assume, at a much younger age in many traditional societies than you would perhaps become a grandmother here. So that could affect role, too. So
absolutely.
How, in your studies, how did you compensate for age-related roles?
By acknowledging that in my lecture. And I mentioned the caveat that a downside, yes, there's an upside to increased role of grandparenting today with more and more childbearing age people out in the workforce, but a downside is exactly as you say, that people becoming grandparents not in their 35s, 40s, 45s as they used to, but 70s and 80s. I'm 75 and I'm not yet a grandparent, which means that when I finally hopefully become a grandparent, I'm going to have less energy than when I was 40 years old. So it's something that one has to be aware of.
Gentleman on our left in the second row.
I heard some time back of something called the grandmother theory, which suggested that human brain development was encouraged in a time long ago when grandmothers took over care of the children so that the mother could do other foraging activities, such as that way, way back in the foraging days. Hmm. I'm thinking about that versus the changes now where the grandmother isn't necessarily part of the picture.
That phenomenon that you mentioned for Taiwan, grandparents, grandmothers taking over responsibility for the kids while the parents of the kids go off forage, that observation that you made for Taiwan is widespread. It's also the case that I mentioned for the Hadza, and I would say it's the case in most, maybe all hunter-gatherer societies that have been observed, that the grandparents, if they're still alive and capable of doing it, often take responsibility, staying in camp and looking after the children, looking after their grandchildren, thereby freeing up their own children, the parents of the grandchildren, to go off hunting and gathering, freeing them up. Not just Taiwan, but it's a widespread phenomenon.
Well, I wasn't talking about Taiwan, but it was a general thing for human development, for brain development.
General thing for brain development, that would be...
The educational possibilities and information...
The educational possibilities and the information being passed on by grandparents that we know parents don't do as much as grandparents do, or family.
Also, grandparents have 30 or 40 more years behind them to acquire information to pass on to their grandchildren.
Gentleman right behind you in the blue.
You touched briefly on the differences in warfare between traditional and modern societies. Could you say more about that, please?
Yeah, the differences in warfare between traditional and modern societies come as a big surprise to people who hear about them. Often, traditional societies are idealized as peaceful, but there are lots of studies of traditional tribal societies, and the cruel reality is that the percentage of traditional people who die violent deaths is higher than in almost any state society for which we have information. If you want to compare the worst of the worst, Germany, Russia, and Poland during 20th century, the chances of dying of war or violent death in any of those countries during the 20th century are several times lower than the chances of dying a violent death in most traditional societies. And the reason, it's not that people in traditional societies are more vicious. It's that war is an intermittent affair in modern societies with government, because the government declares war and then it declares peace. And when the government declares peace, hot-headed young men who want to start a war again are restrained from starting the war. Whereas in traditional societies, without a centralized government, there isn't a government that restrains the hotheads from going back to war again. So the reality is that traditional societies are at war almost constantly, modern societies only intermittently, and the numbers show that the chances of dying a violent death in traditional societies, something like 10 times the chances, 10 or 20 times the chances in state-level society. That's been a big surprise.
Another question, yes. Gentleman to your right there.
Sort of a tangent from war. We just see in our own country in recent months just too much pure evil, if you will. Could you imagine in a traditional society a mass killing of children? Do the virtues of the traditional society prevent that?
Not only can I imagine it, sadly, it's common. And sadly, it is common to do killings of children. And friends of mine have said, of course we're going to kill the women, and of course we're going to kill the children, because the women are going to give birth to warriors, and the children are going to grow up into warriors. Yes, it unfortunately is true.
But is there ever the indiscriminate wanton killing the way that there is here, where we're not worried about stanching warriors? It's just there's an act of insanity or easy availability to weaponry, so somebody has an opportunity and they take it for whatever reason. Is there that sort of wanton violence the way that there is in that seems to be at least more recently more prevalent in the culture?
Yes, if you read chapter 3 of my book, which relates a whole series of wars. This is an unhappy subject, and I say read chapter 3 of my book, but people don't like to hear about this. And in fact, many scholars didn't want to believe that the societies that they loved did these sorts of things. But there are reasons for it. It's not that the people are nastier. It's that governments can do things. Governments can declare war and make peace, and traditional societies without governments can't do that.
Another question? Yes, gentleman across the aisle there.
Culturally, you have a few. You've seen that some societies value older people more, and you've kind of expounded upon that to some length. I was just wondering if they do things more economically efficiently that sort of incentivizes that behavior at a certain level. I mean, are they better at taking care of their elderly than we are?
Are they better at taking care of the elderly than we are? Our traditional society is better at taking care of the elderly than we are. It depends upon what you mean by better. Our society certainly can give much better, can give medical care to the elderly. The traditional societies cannot. Our societies, by and large, fail at providing a socially satisfying life for the elderly, because the reality is that with Americans moving every 5 years, it's very difficult to reconstruct the lifelong social circle for an old person. Whereas in traditional societies, people spend their lives where they grew up, and so you're going to spend your last years surrounded by your children and your relatives and your friends. Nothing special is required to produce that result. Mixed bag.
We have a lot of questions, but not a lot of time. There's a gentleman right behind you, and then we'll come toward the front.
Thank you. I wonder if you can say anything about the relationship that each society has with their own environment in terms of the sustainability and projection for survival that they have.
Big question. Relationship of people with their own environment in terms of sustainability and survival. There's variation. There are traditional societies that have exterminated, overutilized and exterminated resources that are important to them. The reason why, when you step outside this building, you're not going to see on the street a elephant or lion or giant ground sloth or camel or any of the animals that used to be in North America 14,000 years ago is very likely because of the overhunting of the large animals of North America and South America by human colonists. Eleanor Ostrom, the famous economist for the University of Indiana, and this may be a good note, in fact, on which to sum things up for the last question. Eleanor Ostrom was interested in the question you raised. What are the circumstances under which traditional societies manage their resources well, and under what circumstances do they overexploit their resources as we are doing today? And to sum up a life's work for which she got a Nobel Prize in one or two sentences, Eleanor Ostrom found that traditional societies were much more likely to take good care of and to manage sustainably their resources under two conditions. First, if they could exclude outsiders and be the only ones themselves utilizing those resources. And secondly, if they had confidence, they would pass on the resources to their own children. If they were confident, they would pass on that fishery, that land, those forests to their own children. And if they were sure that they would keep outsiders out, then they would take good care of the resources. Whereas if they couldn't exclude outsiders, and if they were not confident they could pass on the resources to their kids, then they reasoned correctly. Somebody else is going to chop those trees down, so we might as well do it ourselves. That's perhaps a good note on which to end.
Please join me in thanking Professor Jared Diamond. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.